You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. It's about 9.5 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Friday, July the 27th, and it's time for our Friday Week in Review, where we talk with two guests from different perspectives about the news of the week. The state budget has a long way to go before it's finished. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez is under fire yet again. Senator Russ Feingold is considering another censure resolution. We'll talk about these stories and more during this hour, and we'll welcome your observations from the news this week, too, at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. We are happy to have with us Anne Althaus, blogger, professor of law at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Good morning.
Good morning.
There you go. And Bill Leaders is the news editor of Isthmus. He is also the president of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council and author of Cry Rape. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning.
Well, let's. I'm going to start with the story that's been leading some of the newscasts this morning, involving Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. Now, Democrats are calling for a perjury investigation, including U.S. Senator Russ Feingold of Wisconsin, and we heard from Senator Chuck Schumer as well this week, who's sorely disappointed in Alberto Gonzalez's testimony this week.
We're here at a sad moment. We're asking the Solicitor General to appoint a special counsel to investigate potential perjury by the Attorney General. Earlier this week, Attorney General Gonzalez testified before the Judiciary Committee, and his inability to answer simple and straightforward questions was just stunning.
Now, Professor Althaus, I recall in the past when we've talked about this this investigation and this scandal over the firing of U.S. attorneys and other issues that Alberto Gonzalez is in hot water for, that you thought that this was kind of going to go away. Do you think it's going to go away?
Well, I think it's a political tool that's been fairly effective. I mean, I don't know how effective the Democratic Congress really has been, but they have to have something that looks effective. They've had so many things that have looked ineffective, the immigration reform, the efforts at changing the situation with the war and so on. So I think this is the place where they think they have traction. So I do expect to see them exploit it.
Yeah. Well,
whether that makes me admire them or not is a different question.
Do you think that the Attorney General may have committed perjury?
I think he's trying to be careful, and in being so careful, because he knows they're trying to set a perjury trap for him, I think in being so careful, he can sound a bit ridiculous. I was watching the mockery on The Daily Show and so on, and I was laughing, because in fact, they keep pursuing him with questions, and then his answers seem non-responsive, and I think he's being careful. And then that's a subject of ridicule, whether they can actually catch him in something that doesn't match up and call that perjury or not. I don't know. I think it's a problem. I think he's being careful. Whether he's been careful enough is another matter.
Yeah.
But I don't think we've seen the end of it.
What do you think, Bill?
Well, I certainly don't think that the reaction to Alberto Gonzalez is a tool by the Democrats for political purposes exclusively. I think it represents bipartisan disgust with the Attorney General. I mean, Arlen Specter, Senate Republican, is among those who have spoken out against Gonzalez. I think in this last Senate Judiciary appearance, there was just a direct attempt at obfuscation. The New York Times had a great line about it. It said that he contradicted himself so frequently that it was hard to believe he was even trying to tell the truth. But in previous testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee, I don't think there's any question that Alberto Gonzalez perjured himself. He said things point blank, which have since been demonstrated to not be true, that have been flat out contradicted by other people. He said that he had not engaged in discussions about the firing of these 9 U.S. attorneys, and then it turned out that he had engaged in discussions. Other people came forward and testified that they had discussed it with him. He said that there was no internal controversy or dissent over the wiretap program, when in fact there was such internal controversy and dissent that there was threatened mass resignations by a large number of high-ranking Justice Department officials. So it was clearly a lie told to Congress.
Yeah, and wasn't he saying that he wasn't pressuring Ashcroft in the hospital room over the wiretapping?
That's what he's saying now, but the people who were there testified previously that it did appear to be an attempt to take advantage of a sick man.
Now, the question was whether
it was laying on him.
But was he in a, what were they were doing something with him, but what the issue was, whether it was the surveillance program or not, you know, that's where there's the technical question of whether it's actually perjury. Something went on there, but there's a conflict in the testimony. We don't know that he's perjured himself. I agree that he looked like he wasn't trying to tell the truth, because I think he was very aware that he was in essentially a perjury trap and he was trying not to get trapped. It doesn't look pretty, though, when someone
does that. There's an easy way to extricate yourself from a perjury trap, and that's to tell the truth. That's what he seems to have trouble with.
Let's listen to Senator Russ Feingold. He was on Meet the Press, I think, on Sunday, explaining why he thought the president and vice president and other Bush administration officials should be censured.
The Bush administration is now coming to its end, although it may seem like it's been forever to some people. The fact is that we are getting near the end of an historical period. And frankly, many people, including me, believe this is one of the worst administrations in American history. And if it was simply that, I think we could just say, fine, we'll have a new president in a little while and move on. But with regard to the entry and continuation of the war in Iraq, as well as the attack on the rule of law and the Constitution that this administration has undertaken, I believe somehow we have to act to show in the historical record that we thought this was wrong.
I take that back. Well, he did announce that on Meet the Press, but Senator Feingold joined me earlier this week, and I think that was from him speaking on this talk show earlier this week. Bill Leaders, your thoughts on Senator Feingold bringing back the censure issue?
Bully for him. I hope he brings it back again and again, and we'll watch the amount of support for it grow. Maybe it will never reach critical mass, but it is an appropriate gesture on the part of the legislative branch to seek censure of this administration. What we have seen under the Bush administration has been a dramatic expansion of executive power and casual contempt for the rule of law. These are things that demand that Congress, in its constitutional role, stand up for itself and stand up for the separation of powers that has served this country well. If it doesn't, the next president will inherit the tremendous increase of powers that the Bush administration has secured, and the potential for abuse will be as great with every other president as it's been for this administration. Congress needs to stand up. It needs to send a message that what the Bush administration has done and the disregard it's shown for the rule of law cannot stand.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of staying within one's power, I think the power of Congress is the legislative power. So why doesn't Congress legislate instead of emptily expressing its disapproval of the president? The president has the executive power. Maybe he has overstepped it, but for Congress to simply express its disapproval through a censure motion, I don't think that that's particularly legislative. Let them impeach him if they want. They have that power. Not the Senate. The Senate can't initiate that. But let them legislate. Let them do something effective and prove that they can do something with the power that they've gotten. They haven't made any progress on what they want to do with the war. They've failed in other legislative efforts. And now they're going into this pure political gesturing in the run-up to the presidential election. I don't buy it. I don't think it's effective. And I think Harry Reid is opposed to it. I think many of Senator Feingold's own colleagues are opposed to it, because I think they know that the American people will react perhaps a little bit like I am and say, why are they doing this? Why are they just, you know, throwing a tantrum? Why don't they do something substantive with the power that they have? If they can't impeach him, move on, legislate.
I think the American people are all for this. I think the only people who are stopping meaningful rebuke of the Bush administration is the Democrats in Congress, who are unwilling to stand up for it.
Could you point to the constitutional clause that provides for the power to rebuke?
What's the censure? It's the power to censure. I mean,
Is that the power of the legislature?
They also have the power to impeach him. You know, I do think
they
ought
have
to.
The power to impeach, they can't mobilize it. They don't have the political will to impeach him, and they shouldn't impeach.
They should. Senator, given what has happened, they should.
Senator Feingold is actually in a little bit of hot water with some progressives who want him to push for impeachment, but he has said no, he's not going to do that because it does take an awfully long time, and there are other more important issues like
getting out of the war in Iraq that should take precedence, but that this censure move would be Congress going on record to condemn the Bush administration for the alleged misconduct.
I think if they don't have the political will and the nerve to impeach him, and obviously it would be a political disaster for the Democrats to get bogged down in that right before the election, then I think they should move on and do something else. I understand that they want to pull off a gesture like this, but I think people should recognize it as a gesture.
It's like you're saying to an employer that unless you have the political will or unless you have the determination to fire an employee, you can't write that employee a letter of reprimand.
The president...
That's not the case. Sometimes a letter of reprimand is a correct
reprimand?
Gesture to make.
We're
as a corrective
about the president.
And as an expression of discussion, as a way to stand up for what your respective roles ought to
the
be.
The president is not an employee of Congress. The president is a separate and independent branch. If you really are as concerned,
wait,
let me
obviously
finish.
Using if an analogy were, there.
But,
I am talking about
censure. But
it's
not a good analogy. It's a bad analogy. It is not an employee. It's not the equivalent. The Congress doesn't have the power to reprimand or to fire the president.
It has
the
power
of impeachment.
And it should use it in this case. It should use it.
I'm going to bring on a
and
caller.
You know what bothers me about this Feingold thing is the way that the Republicans and the Republican spin machine are trying to trivialize what Russ Feingold is doing here. The spin machine is saying that, Senator Feingold doesn't care for the president. He's not a fan of George Bush. That this is all just something extremely shallow and trivial and meaningless. And it's not. And it's an important gesture. And it's an important statement for Congress to stand up to this president and say, no, you can't do that. That is wrong.
Let me take my scheduled break and then we'll take some calls on this issue and more during our Friday Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine talking with Bill Leaders, news editor for Isthmus, and Ann Althaus, who is a professor of law at UW-Madison. And you're welcome to join us at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison 263-1890. This is the Week in Review on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to The Week in Review, and after 4 this afternoon, you can also participate in your views on the news. Ben Marins and his guest will talk more about the week's most significant news stories after 4 o'clock this afternoon. We always talk with two guests from different perspectives during our Friday Week in Review, and we have with us Ann Althaus and Bill Leaders, and our first caller, Tim in Madison. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. I always wondered if this administration, the White House administration, thought they could get away with lots of things by being able to go ahead and appoint conservative members to the Supreme Court so any appeals would go their way, but in the shorter term that they could go ahead and get away with anything because there was a Republican Senate, and only the Senate can go ahead and do the hearing, impeachment. Were they surprised, do you think, and do you think they were trying to or they knew they could get away with anything with the Republican Senate, which did not occur?
Anybody, Bill, do you have a comment on that?
Well, I don't know. It seems like they can get away with anything with Democrats in control. You know, it doesn't seem to have changed the equation in terms of the inability or unwillingness of Congress to stand up for itself and to assert the legitimacy of its power, first of all, to declare and fund war, and second of all, to insist that the executive branch stay within its powers and not abuse them.
Well, presidents have for many years gotten power that powers flowed from Congress to the president for many years. It's not just something that Bush did. It's not just something that Republicans did. I mean, I could name a couple of Democratic presidents who took very broad powers for themselves. Franklin Roosevelt, case of Truman seizing the steel mills during the Korean War is still the high water mark of presidential seizing of power.
But the way
an example of the Supreme Court striking it down. But for the most part, presidents have a vigorous interpretation of their own power. It's a question for interpretation. It's not clear from, I'm a constitutional law professor at the University of Wisconsin, and it's not clear exactly where the lines are between the president's power and Congress's power. And the presidents make their move. They have a vigorous interpretation of what their power is. And it's up to Congress to push back and to preserve their own power using the tools that they have.
Yes.
And the Supreme Court is the umpire in that. But where the lines really are is not obvious. You're saying they can get the president could get away with anything. Then you think it's obvious that the president has gone beyond his power. But it isn't obvious. And Congress has not used the tools that, in fact, it has. Now, we've been talking about Congress using this empty gesture of censure when, in fact, there's legislation that Congress could pass. In fact, Congress has passed a lot of legislation that supported the president, for example, with respect to the detainees and so forth. We're not seeing Congress really use the power that it has, the power to legislate, to stand up to the president. Bill. And that's why the power flows from Congress to the president.
Well, I don't disagree that Congress has not stood up for itself and not used the power that it has. But the way that you phrase it is instructive. You talk about power flowing from Congress to the executive branch. You talk about the executive branch seizing power, not just the Bush administration, but past administration. And that indeed is what's happening. The executive branch has gotten progressively or successively more powerful because the executives have made it their mission to seize more and more power.
And because Congress
that's the
has
trend
not,
that needs to be stopped.
Well, but the way to stop it isn't by having a censure movement, isn't by kicking and screaming and throwing a tantrum. It's by doing things with statutes. It's by exercising the legislative power.
Yeah.
And Congress has not
do?
Had the nerve to do that. Congress
do
over
do?
A period of, wait a second, Congress over a period of many decades, going back to the New Deal era with a Democratic president, Franklin Roosevelt, Congress has passed the statutes that have, the power has flowed to the executive branch because Congress has allowed it to flow. This is not just a matter of the president. Of course, presidents are going to have a vigorous idea of their own power, but it's up to Congress to balance that power, and they don't do it with censure movement.
Well, you have an executive branch now that says the law doesn't apply to us. You should give us a subpoena. We don't have to
No, they don't
it.
Say the law doesn't apply to us. They say
you,
the
you
law
give us
includes
an order,
executive
we don't
privilege.
Have to obey it.
The
you,
law includes executive privilege,
executive
as the Supreme
privilege
Court said.
Trumps all. That is clearly an extension of executive power beyond what is appropriate.
No, it isn't.
What
it
can
isn't.
Congress do about that legislatively?
Appropriate is not a legal term. What is the scope under the law of the executive power? The scope under the law of the executive power is something that the Supreme Court talked about back in the Watergate case.
It's a lot less than what the Bush administration
but
has carved
out. But the president naturally has a vigorous interpretation of the executive privilege, and there's nothing in the case law that says that that the president is wrong about that. It may come to a showdown. Congress can have a narrow interpretation of that, and it'll have to be fought
let's
out.
Have
but
a
to
showdown,
say,
yeah, let's
but
let's
to
have
say
a
that the president has, in fact, gone beyond the law, that isn't true because the executive privilege is part of
all
the
right,
law.
All right, let me jump in and let me bring some other callers in. John in Madison, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, guys. First comment, I'm a hardcore moderate. I think that the war in its conception and effectuation has been just a travesty. However, I think if you have the same guy, Russ Feingold, saying the same thing, it will minimize the message. It's not like Joe Lieberman saying this. Second thing is, I don't understand why the Democrats keep trying to achieve things that they are bound to fail at, making them look ineffective. So it's bad strategy. Forget about the wisdom of it. It's just bad strategy. They will fail, they will look ineffectual, and they will marginalize themselves.
All right. Thanks, Jen. Bill, why don't you think this censure is an empty move?
Because I think it has the support of the American people. I think that it helps show that where the public is much more in favor of it's much more aligned with where Russ Feingold is than it is with the rest of Congress. And I think any attempt to try to draw a line in the sand and say, Mr. President, you have gone too far, is an appropriate thing. Given the damage that President Bush has done to our country and to our international reputation, I think it's irresponsible for Congress not to censure him, not to rebuke him.
How come Congress isn't jumping on the bandwagon if most Americans feel this way, do you think?
Because they're wimps. It's Democrats are spineless cowards.
If most Americans feel this way, why didn't we see Senator Feingold on the stage in the debate last night? I noticed his presidential campaign went nowhere. He's to the left of the American public.
He decided not to run.
Yeah, let's.
He decided not to run because he wasn't doing well.
He decided not to run because he thought he could do more as a member of the Senate than he could
and
as
if
a
you
candidate
believe that
in
you,
a party that would not support him.
And if you believe that, you believe those guys who, when they resign from their job, say they have to spend more time with their family.
Oh, come now. I'm saying what he said is that he wanted to remain in the Senate because with the Democrats being the majority, he thought that was a position of real power and influence. I mean, are you saying that being a U.S. senator is a meaningless job?
So wait, you want to call Alberto Gonzalez on perjury, but you're willing to buy the idea. You're willing to sit there and say that Senator Feingold didn't really want to run for president?
I'm willing to sit here and say that the job of U.S. senator is an important job.
Yeah, let me.
Yes, I'm willing to go on the limb and say that. Speaking of that debate,
there was the YouTube CNN debate on Monday night. It was, I guess, a first in which videos submitted by citizens to the website YouTube were used as the questions in the debate. Here's an example of one of the questions.
As the mother of an American soldier deploying to Iraq for a second time, I would like to know if the perception is true that the Democrats are putting politics before conscience. How many more soldiers must die while these political games continue in our government? Is the reason that we are still in Iraq and seemingly will be for some time due to the Democrats' fear that blame for the loss of the war will be placed on them by the Republican spin machine?
Well, Bill, what do you
think? Great question. A wonderful question. It's the type of question that, you know, Wolf Blitzer would not ask, but it's on a lot in the minds of a lot of people in this country. You know, bully for the person who stood up and put that question to the Democratic candidates.
And what do you think of the answers that we got from the Democrats?
I think one said yes,
but everybody else was trying to say how they were trying to end the war, but...
Yeah, they have plans, but they never quite. How far can they get? But
Congress has the power of the purse strings. If they wanted to, they could stop this war.
Well, it should be noted that CNN did pick out which videos to use. So the idea that Wolf Blitzer wouldn't have. I mean, they really did pick the same questions they wanted to ask. I mean, they were taking YouTube videos now for the Republican debate in August. And, you know, I was putting up some tips on if you want to get your video accepted as one of the questions, what should you do? Well, one of the things to do is to sound more like a real person and maybe push it a little further. But also another thing to do is to ask one of the questions that they actually would have asked if they were asking the question. So they don't let just miscellaneous stuff come out.
Some of the questions, they certainly were somewhat different than what we've heard in past debates.
That went a little further in saying, aren't you guys just afraid to take that you'll be blamed for losing the war. You actually want the war to last through the next election.
You know, another format that has been done in the past is kind of a town hall format where the questions are asked by members of the audience. And yes, you do have a gatekeeper function. You don't let anyone ask any question regardless of how well they're able to phrase it, and people get up and make interminable speeches. You don't want that. So you do have to have some control over who gets to ask what questions. But questions coming from the citizenry have a validity and authenticity that I think, you know, the questions that come from the punditry do not.
There's also an interesting just pop culture element of it. Using YouTube, allowing people to make their own little films, you know, you're not standing there being defined as an audience member in their format. You can be anywhere. You can be, and so one woman was filmed herself in her bathroom. Another guy filmed himself holding a big gun that he called his baby. And then these two Red State Update guys from Tennessee did kind of a little comedy routine as they were asking a question about whether, that people were annoyed that Al Gore was getting so much coverage.
And the same-sex couple who stood together and asked, why can't we be married?
But I thought, you know, those two Tennessee guys really kind of put on a little comedy show, and then they were on some news shows the next day, and, you know, maybe they'll get their own movie. They were as funny as Borat, weren't they? I liked them. I went to YouTube, watched their video, and then went to their YouTube page and watched a bunch of others of their videos, and it was pretty good comedy.
Yeah, so we'll see this again in the Republican debate on September 17th. And is this now here to stay, do you think, this type of format for these debates?
I think people should jazz up the formats for debate as much as possible. We had a governor debate that was actually done on Wisconsin Public Television, which comes to mind, where the three candidates sat down at the table and they talked. There was no moderator. There was no set list of questions. They just had a discussion between the three of them, and it was the best gubernatorial debate I've ever seen. I mean, a format like that ought to be explored for presidential contest.
You have to narrow it down a little. You know, Hillary Clinton and John Edwards were heard talking when they weren't supposed to be on mic, you know, about narrowing it down.
Why are there so many people here?
But if you could get it down to three, if you could just get Edwards, Clinton, and Obama sitting down at a table talking using that Wisconsin governor method, that would be great.
Well,
but you'd have to eliminate a few.
It would be kind of fun to
others.
Have all 8 or 9 of them.
Yeah, you know, that debate was a We the People Wisconsin debate that was on Wisconsin Public Television and Wisconsin Public Radio.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And speaking of which, Linda in Monroe is our next caller. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning, everyone. What's wrong with the Republican Party that they want to cut half or all the funding for public radio and TV? I personally think it should be increased, particularly on public TV, so that I don't have to watch those seedy commercials on commercial TV. Now, are they going to cut half or all that's going to be cut? I'm puzzled on that.
Well, the proposal, I wrote about it this week. It kind of blew my mind that this is actually happening and it's gotten so little media attention. But the proposal, the state assembly version of the budget calls for cutting funding to Wisconsin Public Television and Wisconsin Public Radio in half in the first year of the biennium and cutting it nearly entirely in the second part of the biennium, preserving just a small amount of funding, which is used for educational programming on Wisconsin Public Television. Essentially, it would mean a complete withdrawal of state support for public broadcasting in Wisconsin, and it would destroy Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television as we know it.
The chancellor of the UW Extension, which essentially my boss, I'm an employee of the UW Extension, has said that the proposed cuts to the UW Extension for public broadcasting would essentially mean that all of what you hear on the Ideas Network, my job and anybody else you hear on the Ideas Network, would be eliminated. We would not mm-hmm. be able to do what we're doing right now.
The director of Wisconsin Public Television and Wisconsin Public Radio both told me that it would render both operations essentially pass-through services, as exist in some state, which means there's virtually no original local programming. It's just a pass-through for Wisconsin or for National Public Radio and what you call it, the public broadcasting service.
Well, do you think it's a problem that a lot of conservatives perceive public radio as leaning liberal and is not really being for them, and that it's sort of not unfair that the liberals get the commercial-free government support and then conservative radio has to use commercials and so on. Whether that's true or not, but there's kind of a perception. If, in fact, the people who are voting Republican feel excluded from public radio, maybe that creates a kind of a dynamic that we're seeing play out here. I'm not saying I think it's a good thing. I like public radio. But maybe more effort should be made to include the sort of conservative side of the state. So that
I would say that we try
right
to
now.
Do that, but yeah, I mean, we try to do that. Certainly,
where's the exclusion? This program comes on each and every week, and you have someone who represents the conservative position.
I represent the conservative position?
I think you do more
but
than
I mean,
do.
But I mean, a lot of people on my blog, which has a lot of conservative readers on my blog, althouse.blogspot.com. When I say I'm going on the radio and that I'm representing the conservative side, read the comments. It's a lot of mockery of public radio.
Well, are there
saying,
people
you know,
more hardcore?
Yeah, you're right. We try to have a variety of perspectives, certainly, and we do have other guests who would probably have far more conservative credentials.
And I think it's good that, you know, you have people who are more moderate. I mean, I voted for Feingold, so, you know, I mean, I'm not even a Republican, so, you know, I know I'll...
I think
I'll
we got you because
say,
one year you voted for Bush and you admitted
it. I voted for Bush after much
Are you sorry?
You know, I think Kerry would have been a terrible president. So, it was a choice between two individuals.
But back to
not
the...
Not between an individual.
Well, you know, it's the devil you know and the devil you don't.
I will say that...
That's right. That's why I voted for Bush.
What I've heard from those who are proposing the cuts to public broadcasting are things like you can do more fundraisers.
Mm-hmm.
But we couldn't do more fundraisers if we weren't here.
You fundraise all the time.
I know. And that this is not something that taxpayers need to subsidize. So that's
ridiculous. I think that Wisconsin Public Radio and television do a tremendous amount of fundraising. They work very hard at it. They get a lot of support from the citizens of the state. The amount of money that the state is chipping in is not a huge amount of money in the great scheme of things. The idea of pulling this all and just abandoning these excellent resources for the people of our state just seems shocking to me. And I think the people who are listening right now ought to be outraged at what is being proposed here.
Yeah, I think dismantling something that's so well-developed, so well-built up, and doing it in a kind of a political gesture that's meant to smack you down.
Yeah, we all ought to be proud in this state of Wisconsin Public Television, Wisconsin Public Radio. We ought to be proud of it, and we ought to support it. And we ought to be angry that the Republicans in the state assembly, if they had their way, would destroy both of those broadcasting services.
Yeah, do you think, Bill, that Republicans in the assembly who put this through in their version of the budget are, in a way, punishing public broadcasting for being, in their minds, too liberal?
Not conservative enough? Yes, I think that's part of it. You know, I'm slow on the uptake on this, but it's starting to dawn on me, and I think it's starting to dawn on a number of other people across the strait, just what an amazingly radical document the assembly version of the state budget is. I mean, it cuts funding for the UW system, leaves $120 million short. It completely suspends funding for the UW Law School. It cuts funding for the Haven Center, for the Wisconsin Humanities Council, for the School of Workers programs that, you know, got up the nose of some conservative Republicans because they spout liberal ideas. It would destroy Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television. Remove state funding for the Wisconsin GI Bill. Right now, people who serve our country in Iraq and Afghanistan can come back and have their tuition paid for. The Assembly Republicans say no more of that. They cut the funding for that completely. I mean, this is a really radical document that's been advanced by the Assembly Republicans. And they say they do it because they care about cutting taxes. But you know what? The Assembly version of the state budget would mean that the average person in Wisconsin would pay more taxes than they would under the Senate version or under the version that was proposed by Governor Doyle, according to the Legislative Fiscal Bureau. What they do is they cut taxes like the gas tax that's being proposed or the tax on cigarettes that the governor would like. Those are the constituencies that the Assembly Republicans are serving, not the ordinary people of the state.
Yeah, I would like to see, for a conservative approach to budgeting, I would like to see more careful management, not political gestures at attacking programs that, you know, are portrayed as being leftist or liberal. I mean, obviously, I'm a law professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School, so I don't like seeing our subsidy cut. But the way that it's just so crude. I think that to be really conservative, I think what you should try to do is manifest management skills and budget with that in mind. But these are just crude attacks. I mean, the attack on the law school acts as if the lawyers that we produce all become personal injury lawyers.
Yes.
And we do need some personal injury lawyers. You know, maybe you'll get injured.
Ambulance
sometime. You'll
chasers
need a lawyer.
Is what you said.
But the idea that that's what most lawyers do is absurd. I mean, lawyers help people in businesses structure their deals and defend against lawsuits. So you need lawyers for lots of things. And in any case, we actually have fewer lawyers. We're below average in the number of lawyers per capita in Wisconsin significantly. And we actually have less law school. Then Minnesota, same population, has four law schools. We only have two. Iowa has 60% of our population and has two law schools, the same as us. So we're really underserved in terms of law schools. And the idea that you're just, going to tap into some sort of hot-headed political feeling about how there are too many lawsuits, you know what, if that's your problem, why don't you do tort reform? Legislate,
you're right.
Change the tort law if that's your problem. Don't act like, oh, too many lawyers. Let's stop having lawyers because there'll be just as many lawyers and there won't be lawyers for some things that you like. So it's such a broad brush, such a crude attack.
When Peg Lautenschlager asked that the members of the legislature obey the open records law, same as everyone else, and sued them over it, the Republicans in the legislature had no trouble hiring lawyers and spending $400,000 of taxpayers' money to defend against that and to preserve their right to conduct their business, the public's business, in secret. So, you know, then they had no problem with lawyers.
Can I just make one more point?
Briefly.
And that is that the law school wouldn't cease to exist or wouldn't have fewer seats for students. It would simply have to raise tuition, and that would affect who could go to law school. And, you know, so who are you really talking to? who are you really affecting? You're affecting citizens of Wisconsin who would like, you know, who've young people who've done well in school and would like to pursue a career path and emerge with a professional degree,
yep,
and not a huge pile of debt that will affect how they make their career choices.
I do have to take a very short pause, and then we'll continue talking with Ann Althaus and Bill Leaders. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, hoping you'll stay tuned. Coming up after 9 o'clock, Kathleen Dunn and her guest will discuss the latest from Iraq. We are talking about all the news this week. It's our Friday Week in Review with Ann Althaus, blogger, professor of law at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Her blog is althaus.blogspot.com. And Bill Leaders, news editor for Isthmus. He is also the president of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council and author of the book, Cry Rape. 1-800-642-1234, our toll-free number if you'd like to call in with an observation from the news this week. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Another issue going on in the state budget has to do with the universal health care plan that was put forth in the Senate version of the state budget. The sponsors of this universal health care plan released the results of a poll this week that said that 67% of the people of Wisconsin want this type of coverage. They know it means a hike in payroll taxes. They know that it could mean more in taxes. They know that it might be a job killer. The supporters of this program used every negative word in the book to try to see if that would bring down the support for the program.
The opponents, you mean?
No, this was the support. John Erpenbach said, "We put these. We let the people, the poll respondents, know that this could kill jobs. It may mean more taxes."
Oh, right.
And people, 67% said we want that. So your reaction? You're surprised?
No, I think I haven't studied the poll questions, but if they did, you know, obviously they need to do a legitimate poll for that number 67 to be good. And if in fact they structured the questions so that they were pretty clear in telling people what the costs were, then 67% is an impressive number.
Mm-hmm. I think there is tremendous support for change in our healthcare system. We have the worst healthcare system that money can buy. Everyone whose life intersects with the healthcare systems can see that it is flawed in fundamental ways. I mean, most of what my intersection with the system isn't really with doctors. It was with the people who are processing the billing and trying to decide whether this is covered or that are covered. This is a tremendously inefficient system. It could be made much better. Most of the industrialized world has healthcare systems which are much better. And, you know, there's tremendous momentum and desire on the part of the people for change in this area. The only people who are dragging their feet are the people in charge because their pockets are being filled by the insurance industry who would like to keep things the way they are.
There are people who say that both the Senate and the Assembly versions of the budget are really fake budgets. These are just extreme positions from both houses. And that we're not going to get either of these or anything really close to either of these. Is that how you view it, Ann Althaus?
It looks like something like that, but I mean, I don't know how they're going to get this resolved. It seems like we're really dragging our heels and are just about the last state to put together a budget, aren't we? Or in the final whatever, four?
Well, it's because Wisconsin can continue to, it continues to fund itself whether there's a budget in place or not. For other states, not having a budget in place means shutting down government. So that's usually a kick in the pants to get them going. In Wisconsin, it's dragged on as late as October because things just stay the same until the new budget is drafted.
Let's take some calls from people who have been waiting. Jerry in Waterford, hi, you're on the air.
Thank you very much for taking my call. You know, I'm concerned. Abraham Lincoln said that a house divided between itself cannot stand, or a house divided within itself cannot stand. And well, I see that in the Congress, the Democrats and the Republicans just can't seem to join together. And as a nation, I think we need that. And I'd like to have your two people there comment, if they would, as to how they can bring this about, because we need this as a nation.
Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, I think the Bush administration is helping to erode the the partisanship, which the caller is decrying, that right now there is more bipartisan support for ending the war in Iraq than there's ever been. There's bipartisan support for reining in the abuses of the executive branch. There's bipartisan support for the subpoenas that have been issued to players within the Bush administration over the firing of these U.S. attorneys. There's bipartisan support for doing something about the perjury of Alberto Gonzalez. So, you know, there are issues on which congressional Republicans and Democrats are seeing eye to eye.
Well, gee, Bill, that sounded really partisan to me. But I think what all that represents is not more bipartisanship. It just represents the fact that we've got a very weakened lame duck president at this point, and the Republicans are looking forward to the next election, and they're positioning themselves with respect to Bush in whatever way is advantageous to them. It's if that's perhaps some kind of a dip in the amount of partisanship, I don't think it represents any new love among Democrats and Republicans. So I think the caller is right. That is very, it's very off-putting. And for people who are more moderate, more in the middle, it just creates an aversion to government and to Congress generally. I don't think it's making endearing Congress to us anymore that they fight the way they do. And they seem to engage in political displays more than anything else.
Yeah,
and things that you named, I think, to me, they're all political gestures. They're not solid governance of a sort that builds confidence in government.
You know, and I know that there are issues worth fighting over, and there are divides that need to be joined through aggressive discussion and debate and contention. And, you know, it's not inappropriate always that people in Congress will fight each other. Sometimes that's what needs to happen.
No, I agree. We have a two-party system, and it functions in some very good ways, so it's not all bad.
But now I do think that there is some, you know, growing consensus within Congress that certain things that the Bush administration have done are bad for the country, and that Congress needs to unite a little bit more to, first of all, stand up for itself and for its constitutional powers and role, and second of all, to get the country back on a better path.
Well, one thing Congress did do this session is it passed a hike in the federal minimum wage, which went into effect this week, but that was stuffed into another bill, I think, wasn't it?
Well, initially it was stuffed into a bill which would have had an endpoint for the Iraq war included, but they pulled that out, and then Bush signed the bill which increased the minimum wage by 70 cents this week, which is really great news for me. I can hardly wait to spend that extra $28 a week. I'm just, you know, thank you, U.S. Congress, you know.
Yeah.
Thanks for looking out for me.
Yeah, so you're not impressed by that?
Well, it raises the minimum wage to $5.85, which is less than what it is in Wisconsin right now. Over the next 2 or 3 years, it will raise to all of, you know, like $7.15 or some such, which is, you know, $7.25, which is, you know, a trivial amount. There are very few people in this country getting paid that poorly. It's good for them that the bottom threshold is being raised, but it doesn't do anything for the vast majority of workers.
Mm-hmm. Any comment on the minimum wage going up, federal minimum wage?
Well, I think some people oppose the idea of minimum wage and see it as a more of a gesture than anything else. It's important to some people, but most people move up not because they're not paid what they are because of minimum wage, but because of market forces. And some people would prefer to see the market to have more of an effect. But, you know, at some point you just seem outrageously stingy not to go along with raising the minimum wage. So I think eventually the Republicans do have to vote for that.
This is the first increase in 10 years, too. So, you know, my guess is that the minimum wage right now, adjusted for inflation, is still lower than what it was 10 years ago.
Yeah. Let me, Jean in Eau Claire is with us. Hi, Jean, you're on the air.
Hi. I know you've already touched on the subject of the budget, but this budget, the Republican budget, of the Republican legislators, is such an outrage that one would think that every single Republican, probably with the exception of Jeff Wood up here in the Chippewa Valley area, absolutely hates children and hates the disabled and hates the poor. That there's cut after cut after cut that affects children, that affects health care, and I honestly do not understand how anyone could go on the radio or any place else and defend this outrage, and that is my comment.
I guess I'm not familiar enough to know all those different cuts. Bill, have you looked into all those other areas?
I'm not aware of specifically. I mean, generally speaking, there's cuts across the board that will affect all kinds of programs. But, you know, it is a draconian budget. It's a budget that does great violence to the institutions of Wisconsin. It's a budget that looks out primarily for the interest of, you know, interests like oil companies and people who sell cigarettes to kill our citizens. And and it does very...
Forcing them to smoke.
Just look at this thing about the GI Bill, the Wisconsin GI Bill. I mean, what a slap in the face that is. I mean, do we need further proof that Republicans don't care about the men and women of this country that serve us in Iraq and Afghanistan, that they say when you come back, we're going to pull the money that used to be available for you for college tuition?
You know what? I think... I'm not defending the Republican side of the budget here, but especially in view of the proposed cutting of funds to Wisconsin Public Radio, I think it would be good to have, maybe you've done this already, but have some people who really can explain why the Republicans have set it out the way they have and on the radio.
Yep,
really do.
Well,
a long show.
Mm-hmm. Any comment on the news that we heard this week about this alert that people were finding... Cheese with wires near or in them, and the TSA now is saying there's no credible specific threat. This include cheese found in Milwaukee on June 4th.
It sounds funny, but it isn't funny at all. It looks like it was a dry run for a bomb on planes. There were four incidents, and one was in Milwaukee. You know, Wisconsin cheese. It sounds like a joke, but in fact, the block of cheese is the same consistency as a kind of explosive substance that could be used. And so it looks like they used the cheese with some kind of wires and devices around it to see if they could get it through security. And then if they could get that through security, then they would know they could get the bomb through.
Yeah.
So it's no joke at all. I'm very concerned
but
about that.
Let me read this. I'm sorry I didn't read it. An unclassified alert distributed on July 20th by Transportation Security Administration officials to federal air marshals. You know, so this was just distributed when they found this suspicious cheese on June 4th. Some are wondering if this is yet another scare tactic, Bill Leaders.
Well, it's hard to say whether it's a legitimate threat. It could be, or it could be something that is being misinterpreted, either deliberately or accidentally. We don't know for sure.
I have to say that you're saying that people
every
are saying
piece of
that
cheese with a wire in it is automatically a terrorist plot.
You know. If this makes me feel like I just have to say,
if I
Democrats,
go home and
liberals,
stick a wire
me,
in the cheese in my refrigerator, I'm a terrorist.
Let me just say, you and many Democrats, many liberals, do not take the terrorism threat seriously, and I think your attitude there is absolutely shocking.
You're saying
that's
that
why I vote for
every
vote.
Time someone says this is a potential threat, we have to say, of course it is, and we need to overreact. We need to take it seriously, unquestioningly. That's the only appropriate response. I'm saying it could be a genuine threat. It could be
and
not
could be
a genuine threat.
And it could be just some
people
who take a block
you
of
don't
cheese
know.
And put wires around it. It was like devices. It was exactly the format, the physical format of a bomb, except
well, my
cheese
guess
was where
is if they intercepted
the
cheese, they caught the people who were trying to fob it off, which ought to give them some information
but it means
about the nature of this. Why
threats,
don't we wait
there
for
are
that?
I should have brought this up.
We're under siege.
I should have brought this up much, much earlier
questions
in the program because now we are out of time. I'm sorry that I didn't
we'll
give
just
you
take
enough.
It out of the street.
It's further proof, if anywhere needed, that cheese is not good for you.
Well, thank you very much, Bill Leaders, for being with us. And thanks to Ann Althaus. And Ann Althaus, you're going to be a visiting professor. We just have a few minutes for next semester.
At Brooklyn Law School, fall and spring I'll be in Brooklyn, but I'll try to get back here in Madison a lot.
We'll still talk with you. Thanks
Thank
a lot. Ann Althaus, professor of law at UW-Madison, and Bill Leaders, news editor of the Isthmus. Thanks to both of them for being with us. And thanks to Christina Taylor and Leo Duran for producing the hour. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network.